Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Institute for Government. I'm Jill Rutter. I'm the Programme Director for our work on better policy making, and this is the fourth in our series about making policy better, looking at the role of evidence and evaluation. And it's one that we've done in partnership with NESTA and the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. So you will notice that we have in the very metrosexual apricot, Jonathan Portes.
It's Dutch orange.
Dutch orange. Very pale Dutch orange. Anyway, looks like the shirt Rafa Nadal won the Rome Masters in on Monday. But anyway, so Jonathan, as one of our key partners in this collaboration with NESTA's Alliance for Useful Evidence, and Nisa is going to be your chair for today. Don't worry that you're here for an unexpected lecture from Jonathan on why the government really needs Plan B and needs whatever. We do have a very, very distinguished panel. They are all in the front row so that they can see Kern Toiling's slides. They will then move on to the panel. I'm going to exit very rapidly into the front row. So without further ado, I'm going to pass you over to Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Jill, and thanks to the Institute for Government for hosting this, and to NESTA for co-sponsoring. I'm Jonathan Portes, and let's move straight on to Kern. So Kern is the head of the Bureau for Economic Policy Analysis from Holland, which is. I'm not going to say very much, but Kern will tell us, but I think he's almost underselling himself through the title of this, the world's oldest fiscal watchdog. The CPB is, as we're going to hear, much, much more than a fiscal watchdog, much, much more than the Office of Budget Responsibility or even the Swedish Fiscal Council. I was talking to Kern before, and I read in the papers... I knew, of course, that the Dutch government collapsed about a month or so ago and that they were having new elections. And I read a few days ago in the FT that the elections were in September. And I thought, God, it takes them a bloody long time in Holland to organize a set of elections. And I only found out just now from talking to Kun before, well, the reason that the election campaign in the Netherlands takes so long is precisely because of the CPB and because of its integral function as part of the political process. So I think that's an indication of the weight and importance, and I'm looking forward to hearing some more about how exactly this works and what the roles are. So I'll ask Kern to come up and talk.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan. Usually you start your presentation with thanking the organizer for inviting you and thanking the chairman for giving such a nice, warm welcome. I don't think that's appropriate in this case because he just revealed that it takes 4 months to organize elections in the Netherlands because we are so terribly slow in doing this evaluation. But for the rest, leave it. CPB stands for Central Planning Bureau. That's in Dutch. We came with this long name because we were a bit insulted by being named the Central Planning Bureau because we don't do any planning. We are not communist. We just... but when we were founded, it was by Jan Tinbergen, the first Nobel laureate, who was, even by that time, a famous Dutch economist, in particular in the Netherlands. And he was a social democrat, and that was a time directly after World War II, so planning was still en vogue. It was very popular. The Soviet Union had won the war. Sorry to say so. In some Dutch circles, that was what was the perception. So that's the reason we called the Central Planning Bureau. And that's a name which is so ingrained in the Netherlands, the Planning Bureau. We can't change that. But for the rest, we don't do any planning. I have 20 minutes and 18 slides, so that will be a problem. I start with a quotation from the Financial Times. I had a joint paper with John Pisani Ferry. And that paper was quoted in the Dutch newspaper as zeer relevante delen van Brussel willen bezuinigingspijn voor Nederland verzachten. That's Dutch, but I have translated that below. Relevant parts of Brussels do want to soften the austerity pain for the Netherlands. There's a number of interesting parts of this citation, relevant parts of Brussels. Why this vague formulation, relevant parts of Brussels? No, I will explain later on. Want to soften the austerity package. So apparently my plea was don't do immediate austerity, but do structural reforms. And I explicitly explained that structural reforms are harder to implement than austerity. Nevertheless, the newspapers had to soften the austerity. That's very difficult to get out. It is something like left people want to postpone and then do only reform, and reform is something like a growth package, and growth is soft, but that's all not true. I get back to that later on. So those are the two ingredients which are crucial for the talk. Our formal position. We are just part of the Ministry of Economic Affairs. We are not an agency or an independent body. We are just part of the ministry, formally. And I'm just a civil servant. I'm appointed by the cabinet, which is a completely different position as OBR. OBR, being a later fiscal watchdog, is much more independent from this formal position than I am. Robert must correct me if I'm wrong, but basically he is appointed by the government, but it would be inconceivable that he was appointed if not the opposition party. If the opposition party said, we don't want Robert Schoot, then he wouldn't have been appointed. That's not the case in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, the government decides, which is a potential danger. Our staff is 100 to 150 people, depends a bit on whether it's pre-austerity or after austerity, which is much bigger than OBR is. We are large, we're about the largest in the world. I think only the CBO in the United States has something like comparable size. And I explained that basically the combined tasks which are here done by OBR, IFS and NITER, I think, what I know of it. And we also had a somewhat broader remit, and I will make a plea that that's very useful. Our reputation and the rules of conduct that we obey. Our reputation is enormous. The Planning Bureau, say something, is a headline in the newspapers. I guess that's about the same as OBR, I wouldn't be surprised. But we are generally in the country accepted as an independent source of information. We are day-to-day in the press. We do the evaluation of election platforms. So that's the reason that it takes so long to organize elections in the Netherlands. So next couple of months, in 2 weeks, political parties will submit their election program to us. We do the evaluation, and we come up with that evaluation August 27. And we publish it, and it is a major event in the media. I don't know whether it has much impact on the election outcome, but anyway, it will be widely cited. We work also for opposition parties, which is something strange. So we are, first we work for the government, we're independent, we do the macro forecast and we write about that, and that's an independent statement. But we also work for opposition parties. So, for example, an opposition party comes in and asks, so if we raise the retirement age in that and that way, what would be the impact on the budget deficit and the sustainability gap? We do that, and we do that confidential. If that party says, okay, thanks for calculating this, but we don't like it, we put it in a door, it never comes out. If the party likes it, then we publish it. And if the party says it doesn't like, but nevertheless cites our calculation, then we publish the calculation, because we don't want that anybody cites our work without other people being able to check the way we have come to our conclusions. So that's the way we do that. And that works, it enhances our credibility. The opposition uses our numbers frequently to say, government, you say this and this and this, but the Central Planning Bureau says that and that and that. And then, what comes out of that depends, but that helps a lot. A recent innovation is that Parliament can also ask us questions. so they can ask us to evaluate a certain type of thing. We are free to turn down not to turn down the request. That's important because if we don't do that, we within minutes we have zillions of requests by all kind of parties, just meant to hinder the government, and that's not very useful for getting a better debate. So that's what the reason I say it may be dangerous, but nevertheless, it helps also to enhance our reputation as being independent. We do the macro forecasts. In my 6-year term till so far, I never had any pressure on me to change our forecast. I don't know what's your experience, but generally they just accept what they do. So there was recently, there was a very important forecast. Yes, we wait till CPB says whatever they expect, and I had never any attempt to interfere with our forecasting process. We do a lot of policy analysis also, not macro, but just, for example, cost-benefit analysis. Come to that later on. We try to be ahead of the policy debate. As soon as political parties get their position stated publicly, it's very difficult for us to say this party is right or this party is wrong. So we try to be ahead of that debate, and as soon as political parties have engraved positions, then we leave it like that and stay out of the debate. And very important, we leave convincing voters of whatever policy to political parties. You must be very keen, so that's their industry, and if you get involved in that, that's killing. Sometimes we are asked to be arbitrator in a debate. We do that only on explicit request. And for example, there was a debate between the Minister of Finance and the Ministry of Education on the cost of daycare, childcare, and the effect of childcare on labor supply. Now, we come up with a report, but that type of things, when there is really budgetary discussion, how much, whether the expenditure makes sense, yes or no, we only do that when we're explicitly asked for it, just to avoid being seen as something who intervenes in debates on our own initiative. Even then, there are regular attempts to influence our stance, not so much the numbers, but for example, we've characterized the recent evolution in the European Union as being muddling through the euro crisis. Obviously, the government didn't like the word muddling through. They wanted that we have overcome the crisis. It was 3 months ago. By now, we are happy that we resisted the temptation to change our wording. That happens by ministers, by the prime minister, by individual ministers, or by the whole civil servants. They are dangerous types, civil servants. I must be careful in this audience. But they do that on their behalf of their political bosses, but also on their own behalf, partly because part of their human capital is that they know how our model works, and so they don't like us to change our model because then they can't use that to their knowledge to advise their minister. That knowledge also leads to gaming. There's frequently questions whether political parties game our models. It happens every now and then, but for sure the civil servants, in particular the Minister of Finance, they know exactly how those things work. They study them even better than I do, because I sometimes think that they are nonsense, but they think they are very serious. So they know exactly how they work. So it was one of the reasons that the government set up its package for consolidation 3 months ago the way they did it. There's a lot of indirect taxation, so replacing direct taxation by indirect taxation, because in our model that worked out well. I'm not sure that I believe our model in that sense. So then you're very sensitive to this type of thing. So that those are important questions. So being independent poses demands on our corporate culture. It's deeply ingrained in all our employees. If somebody put pressure to change things, people are very annoyed, and it puts pressure on the director. Being director is a tough job. Robert can confirm that. The election cycle. So part of the evaluation of election platform is deeply embedded in the budgetary cycle over the 4-year period. An election cycle, just this case, starts with a midterm forecast for the next 4 years. We take unchanged policy, we calculate what will be the expected effect, obviously expected because there's a lot of uncertainty in a 4-year period, the expected effect on the deficit and on state debt and all the like. And we also analyze the implications for aging and sustainability of the deficit. Given the fact that all countries in Europe face this aging problem, we are not in a steady state. We are clearly out of steady state. We get this big wave of people born directly after World War II retiring now, and it puts a large pressure on the public finances for the next decade, and we make an explicit calculation of that thing, and it plays a very important role. Then there is this advisory group of fiscal policy made up of civil servants, which is a very strange thing, because they give the political parties an advice on what should be the target for the deficit in the next period. And that advice has a huge impact on what political parties will write down in their election platform. So it says, let's say, we must get the budget deficit back to zero in 2017. That would be a reasonable guess that advisory group is going to say. I'm a member of that advisory group, but there's no present among the audience, so I can just say here what it is. Political parties will take that as a point of reference. Maybe extremely left-wing party or an extremely right-wing party may deviate from it. Most parties just observe this target. Then, given those targets, political parties come up with an election platform, which we analyze. So I get to that later on. Then there's elections. And after the elections, there will be negotiations on new coalition. And those negotiations, they start with our evaluation of the election platform. So a couple of parties sit together, try to form a new coalition. Then what the civil servant staff supporting the bargaining do is to take our evaluation of election platform, take the greatest common denominator of all those election platforms according to our calculation, and say, okay, that's what we're going to do anyway. And now we can start a negotiation on what's left over. Now, so that's basically the way they work. Now, the evaluation of election platform as we do is different from the way IFS does it here in the UK, because we do it on request of political parties. So they are not, a party can just say, I don't like it. Okay, then we don't do anything. In practice, all political parties participate. Of the 150 seats in Parliament, only 2 seats don't participate, or 3 seats don't participate, 2 very small parties. But all others participate, and the reason is obviously that if you don't participate, that's a bad signal to voters. You're basically uncredible. So your credibility depends on your participation in this process. What are the advantages? Now, we use one economic scenario for all election platforms, so that gives a way to compare proposals. We evaluate them by the same standards. We try to make those standards as transparent as possible, so we try to publish the standards before the election, before we start with the evaluation process, and before parties submit their programs. It makes programs, therefore, comparable. It's also improved technicalities in the program, because political parties come to us and then they say, okay, we want that, but how do we want to achieve that? Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, now, maybe you can do it that way. Or do you realize that if you increase that tax bracket, that then people get tax rates above 100% or something? Oh, no. Okay, so this type of technicalities get changed. So it's very interesting. We evaluate that process every time. Political parties like that. Their employees who contribute to the problem, they think it's an exciting experience. Can't help it. In this process, we are deeply suspicious regarding free lunches. If there is a free lunch, we always ask the question, why hasn't been consummated before? So that gives the things. We check practical and juridical feasibility of things. And as I said before, it is a starting point for the bargaining for a new government. Let me discuss two issues, which one is there and the other is not there. Civil servants aren't very popular these days. So any political party says, okay, we're going to cut down on the civil servants. And so we must say something, yeah, you can't reduce it to zero. And so basically, if we say we accept only a cut of 1 billion, for example, then all political parties say, okay, give me 1 billion. If you say you can only cut, we only think it's sensible to cut 2 billion, then say, oh, give me 2 billion. Basically, the value out of the civil servant is not something that is highly regarded. The same with their salaries. So basically, political parties want not to increase civil servant salaries for the next century. But that's not going to work. So then basically, we have to say something out. We don't believe that something works more than that. And I think that all political parties, in some sense, also like that, because they know that this process has no equilibrium. But it is also very problematic, because basically we have to say we accept only 1 billion, and that's a purely political judgment, which is appreciated that we take that stance, but it's also, why do we take it? Usually our legitimation is economic theory, but here it's just a number. We accept a cut of 17% for each government period. Why 17%? Yeah, that's some strange history. So it's a very strange role. The same is another discussion now, a banking tax. Obviously, banks aren't popular either. So any banking tax will be appreciated. So if we say the maximum you can collect as a banking tax is 2 billion, all political parties, maybe with the exception of the entrepreneurial party, all political parties will say, give me 2 billion. So there's also an issue of how to deal with that. Obviously, there are also objections. And standard thing is that it constrains a political debate, which is obviously true. I just showed you. How much to cut on the civil service? Basically, we quote a number and that's it. Also, juridical feasibility. We check whether something is juridically, legally possible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, politics is there to change laws. So how to deal with that? So I'm very careful not to constrain debate too much, because I think politics is politics and they should be free to change whatever they like to change. But it helps to think what is feasible and what's not feasible. The very strange thing is that it biases the political debate to proposals that are easily evaluated. For example, a party wanted to introduce markets in healthcare. Well, that may or may not be a sensible plan. But how the hell do I know what will be the effect on expenses of introducing markets in healthcare? Well, let's be honest. Economics knows a lot, but it's here we are just ignorant. So then basically we said, now, okay, we don't evaluate that. We just say, okay, that party wants that. We don't know what will be the benefit of the cost. That party started yelling and shouting. If you don't evaluate that, it's not taken seriously. So you basically say that you don't like it, which was not our statement. Our statement was just, we don't know. But that's very difficult. So there is a large pressure of political parties on us to come up with ever more detailed judgments on things we have no idea how to judge it. A problem that we encountered, and which might be particularly relevant here, is that our setup tends to favor, the old setup, where we basically only evaluated the effects during the next election cycle, favors short-run Keynesian effects above the effect of structural reforms. Because many structural reforms take 4 to 10 years before they have their effect. So if you have some implementation period, it is beyond the next election date. So we gradually moved away from the Keynesian effects, put less attention to them in our presentation, and put more attention on the structural effects. just because we think it's important that political parties, as I said, reform is more difficult than austerity. So we try to put incentives, because that's the strange way. Our evaluation of election platforms puts incentives for political parties, because the way we evaluate provides them incentive to come up with certain plans. We try to make it up such that structural reforms get their chance. And that's basically, it fits in with our experience in the 80s, where we had a big fiscal crisis. And the only way out of the fiscal crisis was benefiting from structural reforms, but that took at least two election cycles. That structural reform thing also provides the arguments why I think that a broad remit is very important. The long history of CPB in the Netherlands makes that feasible. We are involved in debates which are much broader than just whether the budget deficit is 2 or 3%. We have been involved in the 70s in a huge debate whether wages are too high in the Netherlands. And so basically that was the era of trade union radicalism. Wages were far too high, and CPB helped a lot in convincing everybody that that was unsustainable. And the same, we do a lot of cost-benefit. We started cost-benefit analysis because there was a lot of waste of money on building railways. And gradually we convinced people that really that is not a good way of model. So this basically is that we are in a process of reassessing the role of the macro model. There's two lines. One is this micro versus macro type thing. So we put more attention on micro, partial equilibrium models. So cost-benefit analysis, for example, is cutting out all the general equilibrium and only focus on what is in a particular market relevant. Evaluation of educational policies, that's also the same type of thing. And we put much more attention to those partial equilibrium models in the most recent evaluation of the election platforms. Our current macro model has also, so the other thing is critique on or hesitations on how the macro model works, which are inherent to the macro model. We think it's insufficiently flexible. So how to deal with the financial crisis? Most macro models basically eliminate the whole financial sector. And we want to be more flexible in getting that back. Large macro models, as we have large simultaneity bias in the estimation of their equations. Their empirical underpinning is therefore not always as strong as we would like to. In many cases, they lost linkage to the scientific literature, which does VAR models, very simple type of things, which is a global phenomenon. Also, IMF and OECD face that problem. The recent trend of DSG models, they are even more inflexible because you have all to do that rational expectations thing. So I would like to go to Bayesian VARs, which is a line of evolution that we are currently exploring. We have to wait and see what comes out of that. I was very much appreciated Romer's recent evaluation that was part of what he wrote for the recent, the spring meeting of the IMF. And that is, basically fiscal policy really changing the facts. So I made fun of it a bit, but they are very important. So in the short run, they are very important. And the other important conclusion, in the long run, we are not all that. We have to take care of the budget constraint. So that's the type of complicated trade-off we face. Implications for policy, those are obvious. You have to find a balance between short-run austerity and long-run budget constraints. The recent Dutch experience in that respect. We are AAA, one of the few countries AAA in Europe. Low interest rates, a huge balance of payment surplus comparable to that of Germany. And despite a huge fiscal consolidation agreed upon in 2010, the deficit in 2013 is expected to rise to 4.6%. And so basically the government made a large plea for austerity, additional austerity. That first thing in the Financial Times was basically saying, don't do too much austerity in 2013, take structural reforms, do structural reforms. Impact on public policy, zero. So basically here the fiscal watchdog role has changed, apparently. It is not, in the Netherlands at least, it is not saying you have to do austerity. It is maybe you do too much austerity and too little structural reforms. Well, I think the reasons are simple. That's excess commitment of politicians to European norms, which in the end, now Brussels starts saying, please don't do so much austerity in the Netherlands in 2013. The bad experience in the Netherlands with the Keynesian policies in the 70s and the 80s. And I think also the inadequacy of the discipline. Our advice to politicians, should postpone consolidation, but why? If I have to postpone today, why should I do it tomorrow? So any politician starts being worried, and I think that's correct. So we have to solve that problem. Now, for the benefit of time. Lessons. Yeah, I skipped that part a bit, but structural reform, in most cases, is a substitute for consolidation. And that has to do with the fact that both government debt and market distortions are both claims on future generations. If you have a system where you have a limited amount of cap licenses in London, I don't know whether you have that. It doesn't seem so. And they're valuable because they basically allow you to cash rents from the limited supply of caps. Then by selling them, basically, you capture all the rents that are assigned to all future generations. So basically, the market distortion, the net discounted value of that, is assigned to the current generation. And abolishing that basically is a transfer from current generation to future generation, just as is reducing government debt. So I think those things are very much substitutes, and that makes it very important for fiscal watchdogs to point out that trade-off. We have a very important one that is mortgage deduction. We have an extensive system of mortgage deduction that pushes up house prices, basically because house prices now capture the net discounted value, present discounted value, of all future mortgage deduction. So if we abolish mortgage deduction, even if we do the balanced budget, that's going to make current generations poorer because their house is lower in value, and future generations richer. Nevertheless, it's a good policy. Now, this type of things are very important, so I think that fiscal watchers should enter the debate on structural reforms. That automatically brings you to a broad remit. A scope of activity should not be limited to fiscal policies alone. I think we should contribute to a broader understanding of trade-off in society. That's different from your mandate, and also different from your preferences, but IFS takes that part of your job. And you know that job part. Effectiveness depends on a clear demarcation of the roles of fiscal watchdogs and politics. And now the next bullet is somewhat undermining the previous bullet, this bullet. I think that convincing voters is not our job. We provide arguments, and what voters do with the arguments is their job. And that's very delicate balance, but it's very important. On the other hand, we see currently that there is rethinking of the demarcation between fiscal and monetary policy, in particular for a country like the Netherlands, which happens to be a member of the EMU. You saved from that. The demarcation between fiscal and monetary policy is between politics and technocracy. And we are rearranging tasks towards technocrats. That's the process we are in Europe anyway, by transferring authority to Brussels, which is basically a technocrat business and not a political business. Welfare theory provides not that much guidance. You should always... Welfare theory assigns much more items to just an issue of efficiency. Politics thinks many issues we think is just efficiency as being highly political, so be careful on that. Final thing, reputation of quality. is crucial. Building it takes time, and maintaining it takes effort. So our legitimation in the end is the economic discipline. So be careful that what we do is grounded in what economic science has to tell. And then the final thing, which was in the newspaper this morning, I understood, close ties to the government, using their data, there is a trade-off. The more your data process is aligned to the budgetary process, mm-hmm. the more policy relevant is your work. And inevitably, that undermines a bit of your independence. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was really absolutely fascinating. Without any further ado, I'm going to hand straight over to our panelists, and starting with Robert Choate. Robert Choate needs no introduction, but former head of the IVES, now head of the Office for Budget Responsibility. And I think the key question that everyone is asking is, which of these many and multitudinous powers do you want? Would you find a burden, a responsibility, a joy to exercise? But go ahead.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Thanks very much indeed to the organisers for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here, as always. A great pleasure to listen to Kern, from whom we've learnt a great deal in setting up the OBR and setting about the task we've been given. I'm conscious that, as he did my previous job, rather, you know, he's doing both my previous job and my current job simultaneously. How much difficulty I had with both of them. I'm very impressed that he's not looking more worried than he is.
Well, I have 100 people. Having
to be, yes, that's true, you have 100 people. What I thought I would do is just say, for those of you who don't know, very briefly what jobs we've been given and what we haven't, and then maybe just to pick up a few of the points that Cohen made in his presentation and reflect on those. The tasks we've been given are fourfold. First of all, we've been told to produce the five-year-ahead forecasts for the public finances, and therefore you need five-year-ahead forecasts for the economy, that the Chancellor of the Exchequer used to be required to produce by the 1975 Industry Act. So, unlike in many other countries with fiscal watchdogs, the OBR doesn't scrutinise the government's numbers and say, oh, those look a bit high, those look a bit low. The government has, in effect, contracted out the task of producing the official forecast to us, and it's then up to them whether they agree or disagree with us in public. We then, second role, use those forecasts to assess whether the government is on course to hit the fiscal targets that it has set itself. We scrutinise the Treasury's estimates of how much particular tax and welfare spending policies will cost or raise, and we say in public whether we think that those are the right numbers, in which case we'll use them in our forecasts, or whether we think they're wrong, in which case we'll use our own alternative ones. We look at, the long-term health of the public finances. Kern mentioned this, and I think this is common to many fiscal watchdogs, going beyond the five-year or so targets that governments set themselves. We look at a sort of 50-year horizon, taking into account demographics and things like that. And we also look at the health of the public sector balance sheet, so looking at the loans and guarantees the government's involved in, and not just the spending and tax revenue it raises. What we don't, among the things we don't do, are make policy recommendations, which Cohen's office does, which the Swedish Fiscal Office does. It's not for us to say whether the government is doing the fiscal consolidation too quickly or too slowly. It's not for us to say whether the 50p cut in the 50p income tax rate was a good idea or not. And indeed, Parliament has gone even further than that in telling us not to look at alternative policy options, even if we weren't to recommend one or another. So Parliament has instructed us not to answer the question, well, what would the outlook for the public finances and the economy be if we adopted some variant of Plan B, for example? That was a decision that Parliament took when setting the office up. And we also don't give general economic policy advice. We only produce a macroeconomic forecast because you need one in order to generate a forecast for the public finances. We are not the government's source of advice on what is going on in the macroeconomy. So there's some similarities and differences there with what the CPB is doing. I guess the points that struck me from what Kern was saying is, first, it seems clear to me that there is no one-size-fits-all model for these fiscal watchdogs. There are good reasons why these things differ significantly from country to country. Partly it will be a reflection of the problem that had been identified and that the body was created to solve or to ameliorate. So the OBR was created primarily out of a sense that people did not trust ministerial forecasts and assessments of the public finances. So our remit is skewed, as it were, to reflect that. A second issue is that the jobs of these bodies depend on what other institutions there are already existing in the country working in that sort of space. So a very good reason why we don't have a lot of the functions that the IFS has, and we don't do much of the job I used to do with a previous hat on, is that the IFS is already there to do it, and there would be no point in the taxpayer spending a lot of money just to have us replicating, for example, the distribution analysis, winners and losers from tax and spending policies that the IFS does very happily already, and some of the evaluations of microeconomic policy measures that the National Institute and the IFS are both engaged in as well there. It's not entirely clear that that's a gap that we would need to fill. A third issue is the system of government, and in particular the role of Parliament. The Congressional Budget Office has a very different role and structure from us because Congress plays a very different role in the budget process. In this country, for example, the administration, the government at the time, pretty much gets the budget that it wants. There's much more of a negotiating process between Congress and the administration in the US. We also have a very powerful finance ministry relative to spending ministries, which wouldn't be true in some other countries. You also have, for example, the IFS helping opposition parties with the costing of particular policy measures. So there will be less demand for the sort of institution now being set up in Australia, which is really very much devoted at providing a research resource to opposition parliamentarians to come and test those policies. Although I think there is some issue here about whether we should end up extending our scope in that direction. A second point that I was struck very much by from one of Cohn's early slides is that you don't need formal safeguards for independence to deliver a reputation for independence, but you really need quite a long history of having delivered on that for that to be something to realistically expect. And you've had 45 years or more to be building that sort of reputation. Similarly, the IFS has built a reputation for political even-handedness over many years. I think for newly created institutions in different countries that don't have a history of this, there's much more need for something that's embedded in legislation, for example, entitling you to a particular level of access to information from within government and ensuring that ministers can't fire the members of the Fiscal Council at whim and that sort of thing. So I think there's probably more need for those sorts of structures in newly set up bodies, but that's not to say I would never, I think the CPB is probably the least formally independent fiscal watchdog, but with one of the greatest reputations for independence that you could wish to find. I think a lesson which, follows partly from those differences in formal independence is I see our greatest guarantee of independence as not the legislation upon which we are built, but the fact that we are as transparent as we possibly can be, both about the process we go through in the interactions we necessarily have with politicians and with government in coming up with the outputs that we do, and in being as transparent as possible in the research that we publish. We have to show our working. The nature of economics is that people are bound to disagree with what you say, but they should be able to look at the way we've set it out and say, well, I can see where that's come from. And one of the great advantages, I think, of doing the job I'm doing now versus the one I was trying to do at the IFS is that we have this entitlement to information from, in particular, HMRC, DWP on a lot of the tax receipt flows and spending flows that enable us to pull together a truly comprehensive forecast for the public finances, whereas with the previous hat on, if we said to government we think those forecasts look a bit go-y to us, they could say, ah, yes, but we have lots of privileged information that you don't have, so buzz off. That defence is now no longer available in the same way. I think the notion of helping opposition parties and scrutinising the work of opposition parties is an interesting one, and it was a very live area of debate when the OBR was set up in the first place. As I say, we've been instructed not to to evaluate alternative policies, to evaluate opposition policies, and to have, we have a perfectly friendly informal engagement with the opposition, but not that sort of formal role. You could argue that because the IFS is doing that to a considerable degree anyway, maybe there's not a need for that to the same degree. I think it would, for many of the reasons that Kern has described, actually be good for the parties, good for public debate, good for democracy, if there was that broader role. And certainly the experience of the IFS was that helped cement the IFS's reputation for independence and even-handedness, not undermining it. That said, I can entirely understand when we were created why parliamentarians were reluctant about that. Partly because we would have been thrown straight into the debate about which is right, Plan A or Plan B, which, as I say, Parliament has told us not to answer that question. If they'd told us to answer it, I'm sure we would have given a less unequivocal answer than many people would have liked. It's a difficult question, notwithstanding the very strongly held views on both sides. And so I think it's understandable that people would want to see the OBR establish its reputation and its impartiality and its integrity in a narrow remit before extending it in that potentially politically contentious way. But I do think it's something that when the role of the OBR is reviewed after its first 5 years, I think Parliament should have another look at again. I would draw a distinction, though, between two aspects of different policies. The sort of question, is Plan A or Plan B right, is a very difficult question, but it's not a colossally labour-intensive question. We wouldn't need to be a much larger organisation in order to have a stab at answering that. That's very different from, should we provide the resource to allow any opposition party to come to us with some wheeze for changing the taxation of insurance companies or the precise structure of bits of the welfare system? If you want to give an institution the responsibility of responding to requests across that broad policy area, you have two choices, one of which is that you have to make it a very large organisation of the scale of the CPB, the Congressional Budget Office, the Korean Office, which I think are probably the three largest budget watchdogs, or the government has to be willing to allow HMRC and DWP's resources to be used for that, and to us to play, as it were, a kind of gatekeeper and scrutineer role. When we are scrutinising whether the 50p rate cut is going to raise as much as the government says it is, we don't have all the micro expertise ourselves to do that. We talk to HMRC, we interrogate their analysis, and come up with answers that way. So if you were to extend the role of the OBR into that sort of opposition policy costing area, it wouldn't just be a decision for whether we should have our powers extended somewhat. It would have to be a decision about whether you really want the existing organs of government to have a much more important role there. And in historically, opposition parties have had some entitlement to that sort of help from within government, but have been very reluctant to use it. They've always much preferred to come to the IFS because they think they'll get a freer exchange, and that maybe there's some lingering concern that ministers or spads will get to hear about it if it's being done within a department. So when the coalition agreement was being put together, all the coalition discussions were underway. You know, fortunately, we had looked over both the Tory and the Lib Dem plans, and we were asked at that time to provide some assistance in helping to pull that together. But in an ideal world, maybe that should be happening within the public space. There were various other bits on that. I could go on about the relative merits of DSG models and Bayesian VARs, partly out of ignorance and partly out of sparing everybody. Yes, I will come to that in questions if anybody would like.
Thanks very much, Robert. Interesting to hear your views on the opposition program question in particular. We'll move straight on to Kevin Collins, former chief executive of Tower Hamlets and now head of the Education Endowment Foundation, which in one particular area of policy is an independent body charged with both with devising or inviting proposals for programs and for evaluating and publishing the results. And I'm sure Kevin will tell us about it.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I mean, I must say I'm rather nervous doing this. I mean, given the kind of state of European finance and the quality of people we've got here, we should probably stay on economics. But I'm going to divert a slight from it, talk about education policy and children's policies if I can, which, of course, I believe is a key route out of the issues. And anyway, it's interesting listening to the presentation and looking more deeply at some of the lessons learned that have been presented by the Bureau. Just so I can say who we are and what I do, interestingly, a miracle really, given the economic circumstances, about a year ago, the government decided to endow £125 million for an independent charity, a new charity called the Education Endowment Foundation. And working with other fundraisers managing that money, we'll be spending about £225 million over the next 10 years or so, trying to evaluate, support, rigorously understand, build the evidence of what works, to raise the attainment of our lowest performing children, our most disadvantaged children in England, particularly those who come from families of economic deprivation. Now, I won't go on about it, but the evidence is crystal clear. We could do better, we must do better, and other countries are doing much better, particularly with the issue of the gap, as we call it, this disparity between rich and poor children and their outcomes in education. Now, what I find interesting, and I think it has to be applauded, is that the approach the government have taken, which actually has widespread support, is to say, let's create an independent organisation, let's give it some, in education terms, significant resources to have a look at this question, to try and back what works. And we've, at the moment, on the board, the way we make our decisions, going to the independence point, there's no one from the DfE on the board, there's no politicians on the board, it's an independent organisation supported by a couple of charities that got together and won the tender to do the job, the Sutton Trust, you might have heard of, and the Impetus Charity. Essentially, what we do with that resource is that we invite anybody who's a not-for-profit organisation to bring proposals to us, we back them, and then critically, which hasn't been done so much in English education, is we rigorously, independently evaluate them from a panel of 10 leading research organisations, including organisations like Jonathan's, the Institute of Fiscal Studies and other universities. That is to build an evidence base of what works. And it seems to me this independence question for the teaching profession, for education, is really interesting because we have had a period of massive investment, massive change, but in a way it's new to teachers from applying evidence in a way that creates professionalism. And the three lessons that I picked up looking at the work the Bureau presented, which I wanted to quickly talk about, were whether or not my lessons after a year about this, and this is, I was so taken by the point about it's very attractive to get close to policy again. Before Tower Hamlets, I was working in central government, and people want to talk to you again in central government, which is interesting after Tower Hamlets. But anyway, you get close to policy again, but you can see the danger of that straight away. You're getting dragged into solutions, you're getting dragged into support, and it's always enticing and you feel an obligation, but on the other hand, it begins to question your independence. And that trade-off, I thought, was a very important point, which certainly a takeaway for me. But the first key lesson for me after the first year is there a willingness to give us the time to do the job? There is still an instinctive belief that you can do it quickly. What do you mean we have to wait 3 years or 4 years for the result of a rigorous, randomly controlled assessment about whether that makes a difference to children's learning? Because, of course, you get two attacks. You get one, but what about the children right now? And there's this imperative to solve their problem right now. 100,000 children took their reading test last Monday and will arrive at secondary school in September unable to read at the expected level. And that's a fact for this year, and it's a fact for many years gone. How do we, that is an issue. Those children have a 1 in 15 chance of getting GCSEs now because they got level 4. What are you going to do about the children next year who are going to be taking their reading test? Can we reduce that number? What can we do right now? Let's get stuck in rather than wait for good evaluations that tell you what really make a difference. Are we willing to take the time? Education policy is littered, I think, with reforms of good intentions without evidence that then just fade away. I'll just give you one great example would be we found through good evidence and good research that the effect of teaching assistants in classrooms overall is pretty negligible. For the poorest children, it actually can be negative. There are some teachers who do a great job, but the overall impact of that enormous investment, tens of thousands of people, £2.4 billion a year spent, has been pretty negligible. And we need to understand, how do we make teaching assistants to be good teaching assistants rather than some of the work. So again, it's taken us research and time to, but for a while it was a given truth in education, you've got more money by teaching assistants, and we went and did it in spades. So time, I think this is the big question in this one. The second is this issue about the desire to specialise against what we know to be the broader agenda in children's lives. So at the moment in government, there is an understandable focus right in the heart of the classroom, even down to a particular dimension of teaching reading around one mm-hmm. aspect, around something, for example, called synthetic phonics. Now, reading is a broad agenda, but we believe we have the answer. So this desire to specialise against what we should perhaps be thinking about, and which will be allowed in the independent kind of approach to think about, is children's lives are broad and varied, and lots of things come to bear if you're going to reduce the inequality gap, not least, turning to the Economist, the whole, you know, the relationship between wealth, income, and inequality. And we know that there is a strong correlation between the income of your family and your wealth and education and attainment. And what might you do to get more families out of poverty in order to raise education attainment and close the gap? So there is this issue of the broader agenda versus the narrow. And I think that's a test for the system. We're being encouraged to go narrow and narrow. In fact, is there independence and freedom to think broadly about some of the issues in children's lives if you really want to narrow this attainment gap? Which, by the way, is bigger in England than it is in any other European country. It's bigger in any other country, say the United States of America. We just had a recent summit for a couple of days with US, Canada, England, and Australia. And of course, in England, the inequality gap is twice the size of Canada, as we're trying to understand all these questions. So are we up for the bigger discussion? And finally, I think this point of making visible the demarcation lines between the roles of politicians and experts. And for me, the experts I'm talking about now are practitioners, teachers, those who are in the lives of children. There does seem to me increasing examples where politicians and policy, rather than politicians, wants to go right into the detail of what you do every day as a teacher. And I'm hoping through an independent kind of approach, we're able to equip teachers with the knowledge at a professional level, because I think there is a neutering of the profession, which takes away responsibility and confidence and creates a passivity, and we wait to be told what to do in a way that doesn't deal with the issues. So finally, for me, I absolutely applaud the desire to create an independent opportunity. I'm very grateful to be leading it, but there are those questions in my head. Are we ready to give it time? Are we ready to handle that? Are we let it have the scope it needs to attend to the issue if the issue is inequality? And are we ready to ask politicians to accept the demarcation line when we're giving it to teachers rather than to pet projects?
Thank you much, Kevin. And I'll now move on to Gareth Davis. Gareth is director of, is it the Office for Civil Society still? At the Cabinet Office. But I think more relevantly in this is leading on the government's What Works initiative. So very much from the other side of the fence, as somebody who both has a strong interest in making policy better, but also has political constraints and masters to serve and to make sure that this works for government and politicians as well. So, Gareth.
Sure, thank you very much. I think there's one sort of opening reflection I've got on the Dutch experience. It's pretty fruity compared to what goes on in the UK. It feels a long way away from any of the debate, frankly, we're having internally or externally. You know, so the role you play in, especially around oppositions, around the manifesto processes, around setting out some of the choices and trade-offs of policy feel, frankly, a big jump from where we are at the moment. So we may come back to that more in questions. Shall I just reflect on sort of the debate we're having within the Cabinet Office and with quite a lot of people in the audience, just give you a sense of where we are on this. So where's this come from? What's this What Works idea? I mean, as ever, catalysed really by a comment from Jeremy Hayward when he was made Cabinet Secretary back in January this year. And his sort of opening question, which is, you know, very good high-level question, why don't we have a NICE for social policy? Why don't we have an Institute for Fiscal Studies for social policy? And it's real questions. Look, you know, despite austerity, we're still spending £700 billion, but we know we're going to take our £80 billion in this spending review. Look at the Chancellor's figures in the budget, a further £40 billion in the next spending review, absent a plan B. So how can we can either do this two ways. We can either do it firstly by just salami slicing our way through and doing less, or we can actually think, well, actually, are we spending this money effectively, and can we do better for less? And we know we spend a fortune on research. That's great, both internally and through the ESRC and the various other research bodies. But does that actually really inform the decisions that are being made? Okay, back to your point. Do politicians and do policymakers really make the most effective use of that incredible spend? So that was the exam question. So what do we do since then? Jonathan, you said I was leading the work on this. Especially, I try and use the language of stewarding the work. Nudging might be the more sort of politically acceptable phrase at the moment. But there is something in this. What we're trying to look at really is through a group of us, we're working together with people like Nesta, lots of research councils, ESRC in particular, range of departments represented here. It's really trying to understand essentially how we can actually make that connection through from research through to the actual people who make the decisions. Now, the economist in me always comes back to supply and demand. But here, I think what we're really looking at is a sort of three-way split. And the questions we've been asking ourselves is, firstly, are we generating the right evidence? Are we communicating it effectively? And to what extent should we really be embedding it in the decision-making process? So just sort of touching on those in particular, I think firstly is generation issues. Are we generating the right research? We spend billions on research, and when Jonathan, Rebecca, and I were all on DWP, I always felt the research there was great. They produced really high-quality papers, but it always felt that they were answering yesterday's problem tomorrow. And it felt like there's constantly, well, this is great, but if only we'd known about it a year and a half ago, that would have been great. Similarly, we all know we want to do more RCTs. We want to do more randomized control trials. Politically tricksy, because no one likes doing trials on people through social policy, quite understandable reasons, but also the fact that the time it takes to do it. It seemed to be this, sort of, as you say, Kevin, sort of a three-year, five-year program. To what extent can we actually embed this into the design program from the get-go? Because actually, if you look at some of the work that the Nudge team and the Cabinet Office have been doing with HMRC, you can do this in real time. You can change the way which different letters are used and issued for debt collection. And you can do the randomized control trial and get the data back actually in real time. We're getting the data back now, month to month, not in 3 years' time. So question, how can we start to embed that? Similarly, on the generation point, Robert, you're talking about the access to data, which I think is absolutely critical. One option is to have something internally and, if you like, produced by the civil service, by the public sector. Another is to make much more use of data transparency, or just a much more automatic publication and issuing of the raw data sets so other people can use it. So it's not that we necessarily do all the analysis, but actually we can just pump that out. Obviously, some sensitivities here, but I wonder whether certainly feels to me that the default's wrong in Whitehall. And rather than maybe holding some back, the principle more is we hold on to it all and we put out the odd one when our arms twisted. So how can we turn that around? And we've got the data transparency white paper due out next month, which hopefully we'll try and move some of that on. So generation, I think there's a lot more we need to do on that. Secondly, around communication. Again, there'll be small pockets of people in this, if you like, in the magic circles who'll know about the evidence on what works. I'm really struck on education. There's lots of evidence around class sizes we were talking about before. That frankly, within reasonably wide parameters, class sizes are pretty much a wash. Similarly, if you're saying teaching assistants, that's a pretty, it's a wash at best. Often people don't know this. And it's not about professionals being, derelict in their duties. There's just not that culture of connection between the research communities and the people actually on the front lines. How do we make those connections work? Coming back to my DWP experience, I was always really taken how frontline officials, obviously often very poorly paid frontline officials in JobCentre Plus, had an intuitive sense of what worked. They knew the best way to get people back to work was through, frankly, a bit of poking, work-focused interviews, and getting them back into the first job and then doing training. How can we get that culture into more areas? I think we had Steve Aos here from the Washington State Institute session that Jill organized, I think, last month, really taken by how he said, yes, we need to generate more evidence. Yes, we need to do more RCTs. Actually, if we just synthesized down a lot of research, a simple list of 10 or 12 points would get you a hell of a long way. So why aren't we doing that very quick win around thinking about how we synthesize and transmit and translate some of the evidence? And then thirdly, which I think is actually the harder issue, is this issue of embedding. When Jeremy used the language of a nice for social policy, quite naturally, a lot of people jump to saying, well, do we stop people doing things that don't work? Do we mandate things that do? And how does this fit into the government's agenda of localism, of payment by results? I think what all panelists have talked about is that quite right, the role of party politics. I think this is, frankly, I'd be really interested in the discussion on this, because I think this is a really important, delicate role. You could do a lot around generation, a lot around communication, but to what extent do we take that final step? Yes, we may want a kite mark. Yes, we may say, you know, we may have some gold standards, silver standards. I think there's ways in which you can get that out there. I personally hesitate on this embedding, because I think there's a real danger that, you know, we look at what, quote, what works. One, we're often jump over what the objective is, what the work means. Jonathan and I had a great debate about incapacity benefit reform back in the mid-2000s. I think this was when John Hutton was Secretary of State. And there was a real frustration because he felt, I want to do, you know, mandated work. I want to do more work-focused interviews. And there was a debate with Jonathan and Rebecca around saying, well, does this work? And we went around a quite torturous debate. And what I'd failed to pick out is there's a difference between what we as analysts meant work, as in more people back into work, and what John Hutton meant quite, I think, fairly, was to say, no, works means showing that the people are doing something in receipt of their benefit. We are doing something to help them and help the taxpayer show there's a positive process. I mean, we're often too implicit about the work bit of what works. I think also we've got to recognise we don't always know. Most of our data is obviously backward-looking. Frontline practitioners will actually have a better sense of actually what's really going on. Local context is key. We should be very careful about making the parallel between a single pill, medical pill intervention, and a very much a human intervention around, say, welfare to work, around rehabilitation, around working with offenders. And there might be a sense of having that transparency and understanding to really think, well, actually, we can say what we think we know, but if you want to try something else out, that's absolutely appropriate. And back to my John Hutton analogy, sometimes for politicians and ministers, quite rightly, the means are just as important as the ends, and it should be totally legitimate for them to make that call. Yes, they should be faced with the trade-offs, but from my point of view, I think they should actually have the choice to say, no, this is something we want to do, or this is something we want to try. So look, where are we getting to? We've had a number of reasonably informal sessions in Whitehall now, with a combination of people from departments and externally. I just want to give you a flavour of where this is emerging to, and it'd be great to get some challenge on this and see if this is in the right place. I think, Robert, you talked about the role of independence. I think for a new organisation, independence is absolutely critical. I think the sense in which we're going to do any of these sort of what works institutes, they've got to be outside of government. I think there's a real sense that this has got to be something, not something led by the Cabinet Office, not something led by Whitehall, but something that emerges out, maybe that we fund, we help support, we give a bit of focus to, but independent. Secondly, it's got to be sector-led. It's not what nice for social policy or what nice for public policy, but it's much more around individual policy areas. I think I'm really taken by what you're doing on education. I don't think it should necessarily map to departments. I think we should, frankly, have some fuzzy boundaries, but policy area focus. Should be a big focus on synthesis. I think actually we're missing some big tricks here. Having said the thing around sector focus, I think actually there is a role for some sort of leadership function, whether that's sort of a council of the different bodies, whether that's an independent body, to really raise the profile. And, you know, Robert, I'm taking what you did in your role at the IFS. That's sort of person who can work between the different sectors, work between the research community, the policy community, the political community. Is absolutely key, and to get some momentum and energy behind this, I think we might need some leadership in this. We talked about sort of enforcing what works. For a political reason, we've got to be clear on how hard we embed this. I also think there's a question about innovation as well. You know, we do payment by results for lots of reasons, but one of the main reasons is to encourage innovation, that sort of black box approach. We want to make sure that there's not this sense if you don't do, quote, what works, you're doing the wrong thing, and it's a misspending public money. And then finally, thinking about governance, and I wonder whether there are models, you talk about not having politicians involved, maybe there's something about having, you know, a bit like the Institute for Government actually, has sort of informally has representatives from different parts of the political spectrum as some way of providing some governance that's outside of it, but totally separate to the Whitehall process. So look, they're the sort of things we're starting to emerge. Keen to make a bit more progress on this over the summer with the Civil Service Reform Plan. I'm not quite sure when that's due yet, but that's due soon. But hopefully a bit more on that. But look, really interesting challenge on that.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much, Kieran, again, for a really fascinating presentation and for very interesting and useful comments from each of the presenters. I will go straight to questions. I'll probably take three at once. If there's anyone in the next room, I know there's other people who want to ask a question. Could they please come in here? There are a few seats in the front. But I'll take sort of two or three questions at once. The lady there, and then the person in the front row. Yep.
Hi there, I'm there. Thank you. Sonia Soda from the Dartington Social Research Unit, and I've got a question for the CPB first, if that's all right, and then I just wanted to make a general comment about Gareth's discussion around this, which I think is really interesting. So my question for the CPB really was, do you also look at long-term cost-benefit analysis for individual policies, because that's something that we at Dartington are doing in conjunction with the Washington State Institute for Public Policy. We're translating their model here to the UK, so I'm very interested in hearing about whether that's something that the CPB does. And then just a couple of comments really on Gareth's debate about what works and how we embed what works, which is something that we're very interested in at Dartington. I think Gareth's absolutely right that we need to think about how we create the demand for what works amongst local commissioners, because I don't think a top-down model of, say, you know, these are our 20 kite-marked interventions, everyone must do them, is going to work. I think that's about two things. I think it's firstly about your accountability regime, and I think government's got a role in defining quite precisely actually what it means to work, and you build that into your accountability regime through targets for outcomes, for example. And then I think the second thing it could be about is incentives for local commissioners. Mm-hmm. So, for example, central government saying, if you are doing evidence-based practice, we will match fund, for example, money that you spend on evidence-based programmes at the local model. But just a health warning about all this stuff, which is that I think it's really important that as we create more emphasis on what works, we think about how we skill up charities and organisations to take their innovations to proven model, and that's something that we're working on at Dartington, working with several charities on that area.
Thanks. One here.
Thank you. My name's Andrew Morris, and the relevant thing is that I used to be the director of a National Education Research Forum, which was set up by David Blunkett at the DfE, and it did propose what it called actually NEECE, which was the educational equivalent of a National Evidence Centre for Education. And I would just like to comment on why that didn't come off. It was put to the Secretary of State at the time, and a study was made by a working party, and a survey was made of stakeholders about how they would react to the idea of a National Evidence Centre. And in summary, I would say that there was a good stakeholder consensus about the desirability of having a National Evidence Centre for Education. It was very influenced by Sky, by the way, the Evidence Centre in Social Care, and they were represented on the working party, as was NICE. But my feeling in retrospect is that the issue was never high enough up the agenda of any of the multiple stakeholder leaders. In other words, the leaders of the research academic community, or of the civil service, or of the teacher leader organizations. They all thought, on the whole, when they were consulted, they thought it was valuable, but it wasn't a high enough priority at that time for them to coalesce. So we discussed it with the Cabinet Office at the time, Phil Davis, who was very keen, and we knew the same ideas were coming up in the Home Office as well. My comment is that I think times have changed remarkably just listening to what's being said on this platform. I think there seems to be a much greater interest in this issue, and I would think the possibility of going ahead with it. So the stakeholder survey really shows that I don't think there is a single blockage to this. I don't think there is a single party that is preventing a kind of central, reliable, independent centre of evidence, at least in the case of education.
Thanks. Gentleman here.
Good afternoon. My name is Arno Wagener. I'm a PhD student at the LSE. As a junior researcher, I think that the independence of research organisations is very important, that's for sure. But I'm not sure it's the most important. I think the most important is the transparency of the evaluation process, of the research process, so that's one thing. And the second thing is the peer review system, so who reviews the research that is done by these organizations. On the first point, I agree with Gareth when he says that making data more widely accessible is really important, and for us researchers is great. However, there's also what's important is also the transparency of the evaluation process, as I said earlier. For instance, for my research, I'm reviewing 10 years of evaluations done by various government departments, and especially in the field of social policy. And what strikes me is that when you look at these evaluation reports, very often you don't know how, for instance, a pilot region was chosen, or you don't know when even the pilot took place. So you have to read a lot of documents. And these decisions are not explicit when you read the so do you think, so even if the design of these studies is very good, you know, if it's not transparent, it's not very credible. So what can be done for this? And on the peer review mechanism or systems, after the accident in Fukushima in Japan, someone, I think it was in the French government or in the German government or maybe at the European Commission, suggested that the nuclear power plants be, in France for instance, be audited by German experts and vice versa. Well, I don't know if this happened in the end, but for instance, if you look at the proposal, the Commission, I think the European Commission suggested that the budgets of the member states or the member states of the EMU also be not audited but should be reviewed by the European Commission. So what do you think of this?
Thanks. I'll ask for reactions from the panel. Turning first to Kern, the question on cost-benefit. I mean, I think you almost, you answered the do you lose long-term cost-benefit analysis by pointing to the trains. So I take it the answer is yes. So sort of just to elaborate on that, I think the interesting question, though, is going back to you know, we all know how to do it rightly or wrongly, long-term cost-benefit analysis of trains. I can imagine how you do it, whether you actually do try and do these long-term cost-benefit analyses in terms of the sorts of social policy, education policy issues that Sonia and Kevin were talking about, early reading programs or whatever, which is much more difficult and much more contentious. And then on the transparency issue, I think that's quite interesting, actually, on your response to that. I mean, it's one thing saying, well, we've got a macro model, and, you know, if you cut the deficit by 1%, it takes 0.2% off growth, and, you know, everyone knows the issues about that. But if you are, we were talking about employment protection legislation, when you publish your evaluation of that, will it be peer-reviewed in the same sense that an academic publication would be? Is there a risk that, you know, the two or three analysts who happen to be working on it are the ones who somehow determine the direction of the debate on that particular issue, when actually the academic community is quite divided about it? But I'll you first, and then.
So the cost benefits, we do cost benefit analysis on a broad set of issues. So the easy things basically is infrastructure, because there we know quite well how to do it. And all those, so our research programs on that are basically geared towards the evaluation of election platforms, because people come up with all kinds of proposals, and we want to have our cost benefit analysis prepared for evaluating those proposals. That is a bit of the ideal picture. In practice, it's complicated, but we do, for example, do things like evaluation of education policies. And there we do things which are suggested here, not only that we do it ourselves, because that's a lot of work, but we also provide synopsis of what comes out of the literature. So, for example, the debate on class size and teaching assistants, it's well known from the literature that class size, the effect of class size is very limited at best. So, and I hope that has helped in avoiding putting a lot of money in class size. And the same for healthcare. So we provide synopsis and that's it. So here's one interesting example, just to give also the caveat there. We had the idea that we prepare basically a report where we do evaluation of all kind of education policies based on what is known in the literature. And one of the things that came out of it, that if you have more accountability at schools, then it's better. Now, more accountability doesn't cost that much. So here we have a free lunch. So all political... Oh, no, sorry, it was different. It was performance pay for teachers.
That's right.
And there was some evidence, though debatable, that that would be better. So there was a free lunch. All political parties put it free lunch in their program, obviously, because you get collect money without having... But obviously, trade union is against it. It's a standard mechanism. So as soon as the government was there, there were all kind of problems, and halfway they had to cut to find money, so they basically stopped the program on performance pay. So there you see that it is very difficult, and I think that points to a number of issues that were raised here on this side. You need time. The consistency, time consistency of policy is very important, and it is that is very hard to handle, in particular with political parties. You need accountability, and you need to have cost-benefit analysis or evaluation, which is the one is basically ex ante and the other is exposed, to be embedded in the policy process. So you want. So we tried in vain to be involved in the legislation process to make sure that new institutions were set up in such a way that you could start evaluation right away. So exactly, so start immediately. It's very difficult to achieve. Basically, there are a lot of players that want to avoid evaluation. Evaluation is dangerous, even for the people who evaluate, because outcomes are often quite surprising. I like the idea of a go-between. So what we tried indeed to be a go-between between science and policymakers. And then the peer review, that's very important. As I said, our legitimation is in the end that we provide policy advice backed from scientific, so basically in our case from economic discipline. And so we must be very careful that we evaluate the standards of our work, and we have a number of processes for that. One is that if we do such an evaluation, so a report with evaluations on all kind of education policies, we discuss that with so we have an internal quality check, but also we discuss it with leading scientists on those issues in the field. So we would be very hesitant to publish such an evaluation if we don't have an agreement among the major education professors in the Netherlands, because you know that you get killed first, and also it's ridiculous that if the one scientist says that and the other scientist says that, it's very difficult. So we try to be as transparent as possible how we come to our conclusions. We try to communicate to the scientific community and to be receptive to their commands. And we have every 5 years an evaluation committee made up of international scientists. We just evaluate the general practice and our procedures for the bureau. So the last one was chaired by Martin Helwig, and Rachel Griffith was one of the members of the committee. Richard Blundell was in one of the committees. So that's the start, type of evaluations that we set up.
Any of you want to react to any of them?
Just a couple of points. I think a couple of people have raised the how do you keep this, you know, politicians interested in the time issue. I think that really is a challenge, yeah. Not least because one of the most important informations you can get, pieces of information you can get out of a long and rigorous evaluation, is whether the apparent effect this thing has in the short term decays away to nothing over the longer term. And that, you know, there's no substitute, unfortunately, for waiting that length of time. And that's possibly, particularly if a politician gets sight of something that's working at a short-time horizon, the last thing they may want to know is whether it's all going to decay away in the longer-time horizon. I'll just add one Hutton anecdote as we brought those up. Is that he was commenting on one IFS evaluation of, I forget which policy it was, and in some TV interview he expressed exasperation and said, well, they may say that, but I've spoken to people who've been involved in this, and they say it's going very well. So he wasn't hero of the hour at the time for that. The transparency and peer review points, I think, very important. I mean, we try to make use of academic panel, particularly about the methodology that we're doing. Obviously, in terms of particular forecasts and analysis, it's real time, and you're dealing often with policies that are, you know, not yet announced.
And there's one basic rule. As soon as you get in a political debate, there's always a professor for the one side of the debate and a professor for the other. So that's inevitable, but nevertheless you can monitor whether your procedures are understandable. That's important.
But for both transparency and peer review, this issue about accessing the data, and it comes also to the can you actually make head or tail of the 10 evaluation reports you're reading through. That's not easy in some areas. I mean, as soon as the disk went missing when we were at the IFS, our ability to get any data at DWP without being in an armed compound to read it became very difficult. Anonymized taxpayer data would obviously be very useful to researchers in evaluating those sort of things, but in particular areas you don't have a particularly large sample of taxpayers affected, so that gets difficult as well.
I mean, just two reflections. I mean, one on data, in terms of the English education system, you'll all be aware that we are absolutely awash with data. In fact, we have one of the best data sets in the world. So you go to other countries and they're envious of this data set of children over a long period of time, the National Pupil Database, unique numbers. We don't use it very well, that's in terms of this. I just want to look at it from another lens point. What kind of professionals working in the public sector do we need, in the public policy area, do we need to kind of improve what we do? And I think there's an interesting line between the kind of teachers that refer to and reflect on and inquire about evidence. You'll see a strong link between our successful schools as places of inquiry. So there's a pipeline here that takes you from grand institutions which are independent and generate evidence, but this point about putting it to work and mobilising that knowledge so you change the way teachers teach is really important, because we do have a passivity. I was struck recently in Shanghai where teachers are teaching not a full timetable. They're having time every week to actually review and research lessons, and they're publishing papers and all the rest of it. So there's a whole pipeline here about what kind of professionals are going to create better public services, and it seems to me that there is a link here between the kind of evidence we build and synthesise, and I can't overestimate the value of the synthesis of evidence. Our toolkit has gone down unbelievably well, and it's just a simple kind of witch guide about education research, all the way down to seeing teachers change the culture of the profession, a bit like medicine, the way where you actually use research on a daily basis to solve that child's problem. And that must be part of this conversation as well, I think.
Yeah, can I just come on to this point around, I think Sonia and Andrew said, around how do we embed this? And I think this is a classic book. There's lots of it, you know, we could probably go back over the last 10, 20 years of different people coming at this agenda in slightly different ways. So there's probably a legacy of institutions dotted around the country trying to do this. So how do we really embed this in? I think the key question for me is, who is the customer in all of this? A lot of our conversation has come back to sort of ministers and policymakers. I don't think, I'm not the customer for it. I actually think the real customer, as you're saying, is often frontline professionals. It may be, in terms of accountability, in, you look at schools, it might be parents with far more parent power in the system. It could be school academy chains. You can just think there's quite a different range of people who could be the customer for this work in this new landscape of public services. And that actually helps embed it, because you're not reliant on the whim of a good Secretary of State or not. Similarly, it might be about money. There was a really interesting session talking about charities with a range of social finance firms recently coming in from the US. And what they were saying is they really want this sort of best practice, this guideline, so they know where to invest their money for social impact bonds. So you can sort of see, if you start it as an ecology, as a system going, with a range of people demanding it, I mean, that's what is the best hope for really getting the longevity and the use of evidence, rather than resting on, say, the goodwill of a couple of people in SW1.
Yeah.
Thanks. I see people are drifting out, and Cohen has to drift out to a plane in 5 minutes. But I will take, if anyone has one-sentence questions, I will take them. Nick.
Nick Timmins, IFG. It's Richard Garrett. Have you looked at the US experience of this? You mentioned randomized controlled trials.
Yeah.
It's a while since I looked at this. They did a load of them in the States around welfare and work and that sort of stuff. And it seemed to me it had absolutely no impact on policy whatsoever. Partly because they took one hell of a long time to do.
Yeah.
Partly because the world was changing while they were happening, so you weren't really sure about the answer at the end of it. But what did work rather well was, because of the federal system, just waivers for states to do things differently and evaluating it as you went along.
Yeah.
So it's almost action research. You've got an answer a lot quicker and a big impact.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have the purity of RCTs, but it seems a damn sight more effective.
Yeah. Now, I think that's a very fair point. There's a danger we see RCTs as, say, this five-year process. I think so evaluating as you go or embedding the generation of research is absolutely key, critical.
Can I ask a question about the other policymakers call the Commission in Brussels? And the practice there, where impact assessments usually arrive 6 months after the DGs have settled what the policy is, and what are you folks doing to try and improve where 60% of the policy is made?
That's true here as well. I would have one more question there, very quickly.
My name is David Goff from the Epicenter, Institute of Education in London. And there's been a lot of suggestions, and I'm really supportive of them, about how we can make better use of research in policy and practice. But actually, we just need to study this a bit more as well. In health, there is more studying of this process. In social policy, there's very little done. The ESRC is concerned about impact, is investing a lot about encouraging impact of studies, but they're not investing very much on this issue of from research to use. And I think it's a central issue in terms of societal resource and societal decision making, a central new kind of discipline that we need to invest in as a community.
Thanks. And I will hand over to Cohen for the last word before.
Okay, so two issues. I was surprised in the education system, it's indeed a culture issue. So we know that teacher quality is a very important ingredient for outcome. And teacher quality, you know teacher quality, the colleagues know each other's quality, no problem. It's very difficult to manage that because it's just an internal hierarchy in the school. But you can use exam results with keen econometrics to make that very objective. So this type of things, I think we can do a lot to help install a culture where performance, maybe not necessarily pay, but clarity about performance of individual teachers is provided to school heads who then can take action on that. And I think there's more an issue of clarity sometimes than it is an issue of really not knowing. Regarding the European Commission, I don't know exactly, it's very interesting. They will become more powerful than So I had this strange thing about relevant circles in Brussels, because Brussels couldn't make transparent what they really thought, because Brussels thought, please, Netherlands, don't do that much austerity, but do structural reforms. But if they would have said that, they were very much afraid that as even the Netherlands wouldn't obey the rules, then what happens in Spain and Italy? By and large, maybe Brussels can do more than we think now.
Okay, I'm going to wind up because people are drifting away and Kuhn has taken. So I just want to say thank you very much indeed to Kuhn, especially for coming here to talk, which is absolutely fascinating and really quite a lot to chew on for the UK, and to the rest of our panel, Robert and Kevin and Gareth, all stimulating and interesting as always. Thank you very much. There are now the usual drinks outside. And thanks, of course, to Jill, as ever, for organizing and setting this up. Yeah, that was absolutely.